They offered her 25 cents an egg. She had 10 eggs on hand, and she said, no, if I'd sell those eggs, I'd take that food out of my children's mouths. And they raised it to 50 cents. And she told them no. She tried to make them understand that that was her only luxury that her children had. And finally, one offered a dollar each for the 10 eggs she had.
Nice.
And all at once she became fearful. And she thought, if I don't sell them, they'll take them anyhow. And so she said, well, please don't come back anymore. But I'll have to let you have them. So she sold those 10 eggs and got $10 gold piece. They were paid in gold. And they come back afterwards and made arrangements to get all the eggs that mother could save, and they'd give her a dollar each for the eggs. So by every 2 weeks they'd come and gather a few eggs that mother would save for them. She felt like she had to save them some, because they seemed to be desperate for a change, and she was afraid that they would just shoot the chickens and take them anyhow. And they were the only chickens in Lehi at that time. So you can see how important they were to my mother. But while they were there, they would come, and for just a few vegetables, they would give the heavy blankets. For what few vegetables mother could spare them, they'd give her a pair of army blankets. And it's until I got to be a boy that was, well, to take care of myself, I still slept in army blankets. And she would make the army clothes over for me and my brothers. I was one of 10 boys.
Yes.
And she would remake those army clothes. So the army was a godsend to the people, and the people was actually a godsend to the people, to the army. Many of them joined the church and became respectable citizens and were liked by everyone. And in fact, when the army got word to leave, everything was sold at auction, and the church bought up most of the buildings and things of that order, and it saved the church, not only the families that were here in Lehi, but the scenery. From they had made a beautiful theater there at Camp Floyd, and that was taken into Salt Lake, and the scenery and everything, and they had painted the scenery, the drops, and that was something we didn't have in Utah. So that was part of the first theater in Salt Lake City. It was from Johnson's army. The one thing that they did take was their cannons. What became of them, no one ever knows. And ever since the army left, those guns have been hunted for, especially since they've got those, what is it called, the finders?
Metal detectors.
The metal detectors. They've gone over that whole valley looking for those where they were buried. And some stories where they got them as far as Jordan River and dumped them off into the river. So the boats have gone up and down that river from one end to the other looking for those cannons of Johnson's army, and they've never found one of them. Only at Fort Bridger, when they got as far as Fort Bridger, they did leave quite a few of their artillery, because it was too cumbersome for them to get. And almost to a man, those people were Confederates. they had joined the Confederate Army. Johnson himself, you remember, was a Confederate officer. He and his brother were both killed in the Battle of Shiloh, leading the Confederate Army against the Union. So when they say they were ill-treated or that the Mormons were ill-treated, that's an absolute mistake. I don't know of one rape case in all the history of Johnson's army. If they would insult a woman, they were immediately put in chains. And Johnson wasn't very gentle with them. They had them staked out on a 20-foot chain with a 20-pound ball hanging to their ankle. And they could go the length of that 20-foot chain, and that was it. Until he thought they'd suffered enough and repented, and he'd turn them loose. But in my knowledge, and my father being right there, never heard of one Mormon woman that was insulted. There was one woman from Provo that deserted her husband. She was a plural wife, and I guess she got tired of that, and she went and lived with the soldiers of Johnson's army as a wife of one of them. They weren't married, but she lived with that one, but she was a common wife to the soldiers. I have the gun that killed her in my possession. It was made of silver. The man she was living with had been a silversmith in Georgia before the army came. And when he got there, he couldn't spend the $13 that was given to him for killing off the Mormons. So he had plenty of money, and this woman lived with him, and finally she was shot. He killed her because she wasn't satisfied with him alone. While he was on duty, she'd let other men in, and he finally come home and caught her in the act and shot her. The gun that he shot her with is made of silver, a little pistol. He made the bullets himself, and it was a little six-cylinder gun. I have the gun here now, and it's made of silver. That was in just before the army left Utah that that happened. No one was ever prosecuted for the deed, because he shot her, and then he ran out and woke up his companions and said that the Mormons had been there and killed his wife. And the Mormons were blamed for it.
If the Mormons were blamed for it, how did they ever find out that the soldier killed her?
Well, there's always leaks. There was always leaks, but he was never... He, being a soldier, his word was accepted, other than the Mormon men that testified that nobody had been there. But just before the First World War broke out, the government decided to send some men out from Missouri to take care of the National Cemetery at Camp Floyd. It had run down. The soldiers had been buried, but there'd never been any care taken. It was a federal cemetery, so no one did anything about taking care of it. And it all grew up in rabbit brush. And the fence had all fallen down, was a small stone fence around it. And it was about a 5-acre plot. And the man responsible was a man that was sent out in 1940 to clean out the old cemetery and reconstruct the graves and put markers up to them. And he found out that where the gun was from some of the old soldiers, the fellow that made it had thrown it into the pond. But he only got started on the cemetery real good, and the First World War broke out. And so he received a telegram to discontinue his work, that the government would put the project off because they had the war on their hands. So the men that were sent out, among one of them, was a man by the name of Boggs. And the unusual thing about it, he was a descendant, a great-grandchild of the old Governor Boggs that had expelled the Mormons from Missouri. And he was very prejudiced against the Mormons, but he was brought down to the level of the Mormons when the government cut off his source of income, and nobody would loan him money because he had made himself very innoxious to the people. And he boasted on what his grandfather had done for him about the Mormons. So finally the people of Fairfield, the presiding elder there was no bishop, but a presiding elder, decided that he would give him a job. That the spring that provided the water for Fairfield, both for irrigation and their culinary purposes, was full of green moss and in a bad condition. So he decided that he would give this fellow and two or three of his companions the job of cleaning out the spring. He went right to work on it and only worked 3 or 4 days, and he started right at the spring the third day he worked, he dug up this little silver pistol. Of course, he didn't know the history of it, but of course the Mormons did, because everyone in Fairfield had seen the pistol because it was a novelty. And the old timers there recognized the pistol as soon as they seen it. The only thing that was damaged of the pistol was the trigger spring. And that, having been made of steel, had rusted away. The silver was still intact. It was still oxidized a little on the outside, but the man that found it brought it into Lehi. He had heard that there was a guy in Lehi that bought old guns, so he thought he'd make a killing on the gun, because they had told him the history of it. The people of Fairfield had recognized the gun and told him about it. So he brought it in, and he was in a pool hall, and I walked in the pool hall with some mail, took the mail in. And he jumped up and he says, "Are you Hutchings?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Are you interested in buying guns?" And I said, "Well, I have lots of guns, but really I'm not interested in buying guns unless they're historical value." He says, "Well, I guess this one is." And he pulled the little gun out of his pocket. And I knew the story of the gun, and so where he found it and everything, so I was convinced what it was. And I says, "Well, that gun is worth quite a bit, but not to me." I says, "How much do you want for the gun?" And he says, "Well, I would take $40. And I says, that was right during the first of the Depression. Men were working for $40 a month. And I says, "Well, you can go and take the gun to hell with you." And there was another fellow, they were playing cribbage. And I put the mail on the counter of the bar and walked out. And the one fellow that was playing cards with him jumped up and come out. His name was Ralph Smith. He was an old old-timer of Fairfield. Quite an old man, and he had been to Fairfield all of his life and knew all the history. And he came out and says, "Johnny, would you like that gun?" I says, "Yes, I'd like it, but it's not worth $40. That'd be a month's wages for me now." He said, "Well, for me too, but don't worry." He says, "Just don't worry about it." So I said, "All right, Ralph." So the next morning, as I went down to work in the post office, tap come on the little window, and I went to the window and opened it up. The post office wasn't open then. I was just sorting the mail. And there stood this old gentleman. His name was Ralph Smith. I said, "What are you doing here, Ralph?" And he says, "Oh, I thought I'd bring you your gun. Here it is." And he handed it to me. So I went, opened the door and went out. I says, "Ralph, you didn't give him $40 for that gun." "Hell no," he says. "I didn't give him a cent. I put $40 up against it and we played cards. And here's your gun." So I got the gun. And I still have it. So there's quite a story behind that little piece of silver.
How did the people of this community and the other communities act when they found out Johnson's army was just a few miles outside and were actually here in the valley?
There was no response. The people just took it for granted. Brigham Young had told them not to worry. They'd be taken care of. Not to worry, and there wouldn't be one drop of blood shed if the Mormon people would mind their business and go on about their work. And my father heard that, and that's why he went out there to work. And why the men from Lehi went there to work. They'd been doing their part to cooperate with the army. And there wasn't a misdeed done that I know of, only that woman from Provo that I won't mention any names. I'm very familiar with the name because some of her people have tried to buy the gun.
Did any of the people pack up and get ready to leave?
No. No.
It's no big scare in that.
No, way. Not even in Salt Lake. There was a few families that I've heard of since that packed up, but they were on the outskirts of the city. But the apostles and everything went from house to house and told the people that this would be a godsend to their people, to we people, if they would mind their business, which they did. And everything that they could raise or had for sale, the army would pay anything they would ask for it. And they didn't attempt to settle. They went to Brigham Young and he told them to go to this spring in Cedar Valley, which is about 40 miles south of Salt Lake, and they went.
Would you tell me a little about the purpose of the army bringing the cannons and their type of target practice, things like this that you can recall?
Yes, that part to me is very interesting because I got it all firsthand from my father. He was very interested and he used to tell me those stories in the evening. I was the youngest child and the others, they got married young and were scattered to the four winds, but Father used to, and Mother, would talk to me about the old times. For that reason I have a diary that I've kept of their lives. This is very interesting, the old stories they used to tell. But he'd tell of the treatment he received. And to make that positive, a lot of the officers of Johnson's army, not the leading officers, because they were all Confederates. And they went, and Johnson himself and his brother were both killed in the Battle of Shiloh in the Civil War. But they went, the army was dismissed because of the outbreak of the Civil War. But that made, as far as I know, it was an open market for everything the Mormons could grow.
You were going to tell me a little about the cannons they brought and the purpose.
The cannons? Yes, the cannons was the most interesting thing. They had been led to believe that there was a wall around Utah. And they brought heavy artillery, one heavy piece. I have one of the shells of that piece. It was designed to knock the wall down that was around Utah.
Could you describe the shell?
Yeah, it's a 60-pound round ball shot in a muzzle-loading gun. They were all muzzle-loading. All the artillery, they had about 20 pieces of heavy artillery. It was designed to tear down the walls that were around each city and around Utah in general. So the Mormons had been pretty busy to build all of those imaginary walls. But when they got here, they found that that's one of the things that they had been misled on. And I think that is why Johnson was so liberal with the Mormon people. He could see that everything had been falsified. He never went and met President Young, other than his first meeting, when he was told where to go.